Hello and welcome to GCSE English Revision Pod, the lockdown, the first of our lockdown quarantined episodes. How are you doing, Mr. Forster, with it all?
Yeah, pretty well, thanks. I'm feeling kind of like Boccaccio in Renaissance Italy, quarantined in the Florentine hills, telling stories to pass the time. That's what we're doing here. We're entertaining from quarantine.
Yeah, using Zencaster, which is, I imagine, something he didn't have available to him at
true.
That time.
He simply had a pen and paper.
That was all you needed back then. Simpler times. So today we are going to be doing the fifth or sixth episode of our Inspector Calls series. We have already done episodes on Sheila, Class Division, The Inspector. We did the difficult one on Eva Smith. And of course, we did an episode on Responsibility. All of those can be accessed through your normal podcast feed, or you can go to our fantastic website, englishrevisionpod.co.uk, where you will find all of our episodes and handouts linked together by the text which they are on. Is that right, Mr. Forster?
Yeah, and our plan over the quarantine period is to try and finish off some of the text that we've got on there. So we're going to do one today on gender in Inspector Calls. We're planning on looking at Gerald, at Eric, and at Mr. and Mrs. Burling over the coming week or two. So watch this space.
It's exciting times in the Revision Pod world. We are going to bring you a lot of new content. And as ever, of course, each episode will come with a lovingly made handout which will cover key vocabulary, which is hopefully giving you new words. A huge amount of writing good essays comes down to having the right vocabulary.
I mean, don't get me started on that.
No, absolutely not. We know this, listeners. It's a rabbit hole that none of us want to journey down with Mr. Forster.
But there are between 600,000 and a million words in the English language, dear listener. We're going to try and give you some of them.
We're going to cover all of them.
Starting with A.
So today we are looking at a theme question in Inspector Calls. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So the question we're going to look at today, how does Priestley present ideas about gender in Inspector Calls?
And of course, because it is from question one of your literature paper number two, it does not come with an extract. You are purely writing from your memory of the text involved. So no extract, but a huge amount of the quotations that we would use for this essay are available for you on the handout. But before we get into any of that, perhaps you'd like to give us a bit of an overview of how gender is presented in Inspector Calls.
Yeah, I mean, before we even get to that, looking at gender overall, let's just remind our listeners, because actually part of the reason for our podcast is not simply to cover the characters and themes that we do cover. The reason for constructing our podcast around essay questions is what we're trying to teach you is how to structure an argument, moving away from the idea that writing essays in English is simply like vomiting onto the page and like creating a picture out of that vomit, like pushing it along the pavement, all the chunks everywhere.
That is a horrible, it's early in the morning when we're recording this. I've not had breakfast, and that was really not the image that I wanted to be confronted
with. But that's because that's not the essay we want. We don't want the vomit chocolate.
Oh, no, there's a lot of things we don't want, but we don't have to talk about them all in such grotesque detail. But sorry, please continue.
Because what we're trying to do is teach you actually the most important skill is to realise that the etymological root of essay is from the French to try. And an essay is where you try out ideas, you try out arguments to come to a conclusion where you put what you think. So in this question about gender, we're going to try out some different ideas. What might Priestley be saying about gender? And we're going to move towards a conclusion where we say, well, what do we think the play is saying about gender? What's the effect on us? How does it interact with us and our values?
And of course, we want to get away from that common pitfall that students fall into, which is when there's a theme question, they simply say that this theme is there in the play, right?
Oh my God, there's gender in the play.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Like, well done.
The question kind of hints that gender is evident in the play. Yeah. Your job is not to say, here are three occasions when I have spotted some gender in the play. Your job is to talk about what Priestley's ideas about gender are.
Yeah. So before we get onto our thesis, a tiny bit of context, and this is on your handout, the AO3 stuff right at the bottom. It's worth knowing a little bit about feminism for a question on gender. And just some broad brush stuff. You've got first wave feminism, which is at the end of the 19th century, the start of the 20th century. This focused with the suffragette movement, focusing on women getting the right to vote. And obviously they get the vote in 1928, women get the vote on the same terms as men. So obviously that's in between the time in which this play is set and the time in which the play is first performed in 1945.
Yes, so important to situate their understanding as between these two waves.
Yeah. Second wave feminism is then begins in kind of the late 1950s, 1960s, and that's the sexual revolution. So that is all about sexuality, about family, about the workplace, domestic violence, reproductive rights. So this play, therefore, is written in the wake of first wave feminism, but before the start of second wave feminism. But we might talk a little bit today about how it preempts, certainly in its in the plight of Eva Smith, it certainly preempts questions about reproductive rights and things that and domestic violence and these kind of things that become so pertinent by the 1960s. It prefigures second wave feminism in certain respects. So that's okay. A useful bit of context for the listeners to know.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Do you want to then get into your thesis?
Yeah. So what is a thesis, Mr. Kelly? What is a thesis?
A thesis is the idea that you wish to kind of explore throughout your essay. So rather than just giving a few unrelated facts about the play, such as how old Priestley was or, you know, any kind of that nonsense. His dog's name, which was NHS, I believe. But instead of getting into any of that sort of stuff, you set out the argument that you are going to make and you basically give a nice overview of the things you want to explore in much more detail and kind of hint at the ideas of the writer, which you will obviously then go into more detail in on your conclusion.
Yeah, so there are a couple of words on the key vocabulary list that I'll give you, let you know about before we read the thesis statement. One is intransigent. It's a wonderful adjective to describe both Mr. Gelly and Mr. Burling.
Unchanging, right? Stuck in,
refusing
stuck in
to
their
change
ways.
Their views, yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Gelly's famously intransigent. the other one is polemic, because actually, so it's a word we've not really used to discuss an Inspector Calls before, but a polemic is some speech or writing that's attacking something. And I think actually describing this play as a polemical play is a really nice way of looking at it. This play is, it's not simply a neutral play saying aren't things bad. This is attacking what Priestley hated about late Edwardian society and indeed post-war society. This is an attack. So polemical is another word that we're going to be using that I think is quite useful. So
yes,
let's read the thesis then. So J.B. Priestley's 1945 play In Inspector Calls clearly shows him to be a strong advocate for women's rights, deconstructing traditional gender roles in a sympathetic depiction of the plight of a vulnerable working-class woman in late Edwardian society. Eva Smith is wrongfully dismissed from her job by the intransigent Mr. Burling. She is seduced and then abandoned by Gerald Croft and raped by Eric Burling. Even the wealthy upper-middle-class Sheila Burling is marginalised and ignored by her family because of her gender. Priestley therefore seems to be polemically engaging with the hypocrisy of patriarchal society, emphasising the need for meaningful societal change.
Excellent. It's so to boil it down a little bit into slightly more simplistic terms, what we're saying is that there are many things that Priestley is saying are not good enough when he writes Inspector Calls. There are several areas of society that Priestley is attacking. One of them is specifically related to the treatment of women. And through both the characters of Eva and Sheila, we see several different ways in which society is mistreating women and how life is unfair in many, many different horrible ways for women, and particularly how it's unfair for women of lower class status.
Yeah. And this thesis actually helps us structure our essay, because we're going to start off by looking at Eva Smith, then we're going to look at Eva, and finally we're going to think about the inspector's message and how
Hang on, we're going to look at Eva first. Who are we going to look at next? Sheila.
Then Sheila. Yeah. And then we're going to finish by looking at the inspector's message. So the introduction hopefully sets that up for the examiner who's reading our essay. It's pretty clear how we're going to structure our essay.
It's the classic theme essay, really, isn't it? How does one character relate to the theme? How does another character relate to the theme? And finally, how does the inspector's message at the end of the play relate to that theme?
Yeah, and not just how, but like what is Priestley saying? It's kind of getting through to the writer. And thinking,
yes.
What is right? You know, what is Priestley saying about gender roles? And the answer is very clear. He's deconstructing them. He's questioning them. He's clearly advocating
saying they're not right.
Yeah, they're not right.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So should we start by looking at, so first topic sentence, topic sentences are really, really useful. They're kind of the spine of your essay, particularly in an exam essay when you've only got 45 minutes to write. I think it's really important you do spend a few minutes at the start of the exam thinking about your thesis, thinking about the structure of your essay, and the first sentence of each paragraph should really be focusing on telegraphing to the examiner what are you arguing in this paragraph. So our first topic sentence: throughout the play, Prusy's depiction of Eva Smith certainly emphasises the vulnerability of working class women in late Edwardian society.
Absolutely. So it's a great point to start, because what you're engaging with is this idea that these women were the backbone of the kind of capitalist world that the Burlings have made their money from. Without the workers, Burling and Gerald would not have their money, would not have their wealth, would not have their status. And yet, in spite of the fact that they are so important, they are treated in a in an awful way, right? They are not given any of the rights or the conditions that they deserve when they are so important to the working world.
I mean, let's look at some quotations. I think the first one in Act One, Mr. Burling, he calls the workers in his factory cheap labour.
Yeah.
So he's referring here to the several hundred young women who work in the factory. But this reduction of them, this objectification of them to this to a labour force, it dehumanises them. It sees them not as individuals, as the inspector will see Eva Smith, of course, but it sees them simply in terms of their capitalist function for him.
They're just numbers on a page to Mr. Burling, right? They're not human beings. They're simply figures on a sheet. And kind of
like
figures that he...
Like how I see my students, you know, on numbers on a spreadsheet.
You're purely thinking that when the GCSE results come in, what are these numbers going to be? Not who are these people? What do they want out of life? You're simply thinking about their GCSE results. That is you all over. I'm ashamed to say. No, of course we are absolutely joking.
We care about all of you as individuals. But the other one is like, let's look at how many people he has. You know, he says we've several hundred young women there, you know, and they keep changing. I think that's a really interesting line to analyse in a bit of detail here, because the idea of Mr. Burling saying we've several hundred young women and they keep changing is this suggestion that all these women are homogenous, they're all the same, you know, that they don't matter as individuals, that all that matters is the fact that he has power over them. There's this. You know, the male power dynamic here is quite clear. He, as a man owning a factory, controls the lives of these several hundred women.
Yeah, the fact that they keep changing implies that it's not important, right? One is just as good as the next.
They are simply a labor force. And I think that's also, if you look at the tag, so a tag question is where you make a statement and then ask a question. You say, "Are you listening there, Mr.? No, that's good, isn't it, Mr. Galley? You know, isn't it there?" Is a tag question. And he says in the middle of this, he says, "You know." And that little tag question, to me, it implies like the sense that this is just how society is, that the inspector is supposed to agree, is supposed to see this as a universal fact rather than questioning it. You know,
and the inspector's a bit of a weirdo for even questioning the idea that these people for even suggesting that these women might be human beings with feelings and dreams and all of this stuff, that he's the one who's the crazy guy.
Yeah, it highlights the patriarchal structures of late Edwardian society, and interestingly it also structurally prepares us for when the inspector in Act Three twists this term on its head, talking about the millions and millions of young women like Eva Smith. For the inspector, he recognizes that actually there are millions and millions of individuals, and I think that deliberate kind of echo between the hundreds of young women and millions of young women that the inspector talks about, I think it does kind of highlight the difference between Mr. Burling and the inspector.
I think their treatment of Eva,
and then even when considering their treatment of individuals, if you look at Gerald, he talks about how he hates hard-eyed women but loves Eva for having soft dark hair and big brown eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, that hard versus soft, those metaphors are so interesting, I think. What do you make of that?
Well, he likes the submissive. I think soft has connotations of
pliable, submissive, yeah.
You can, if someone is soft, you can perhaps, it's easier to take control of that person. So the thing he was attracted to in Eva was, you know, he doesn't like hard women, the metaphor being that they might stand up for themselves perhaps and give him a, you know, give him a run for his money.
Actually. And hard-eyed women is also quite interesting, because it implies that actually hard eyes are eyes that that question, that see the truth, that don't take
yeah.
that aren't taken in by him. Whereas actually,
but he wants someone soft who will melt around him, and
yeah, a big brown eyes to be looked at. He wants someone to look at rather than to look at him. I think it's quite interesting. And he also calls her fresh and young at least twice. Again, the connotations of these metaphors implying that she's this sexual object. She's it's quite disturbing. I think
She's gone in from Mr. Burling's eyes, she was simply an object in terms of a worker, right? Labor. And now in her treatment from another man in her life, Gerald, once again, she has been objectified. It's in a different way. But once again, she's being objectified as this sexual object for his kind of pleasure rather than a human being.
And Gerald's even aware of this power imbalance because he says that she was intensely grateful and he must have seen the most important person in the world.
Yeah.
There's this really disturbing sense of him playing upon his own power, because, of course, what does he do? He doesn't simply, get her a place, help her out. He puts her in his friend's flat secretly and doesn't tell anywhere about it. Actually, his actions are really quite disturbing to modern readers.
Well, and the question, of course, is would Gerald have done any of this if she hadn't been beautiful? And I think the clear answer is no, right?
Yes.
Gerald did this because he was sexually attracted to her. And therefore, his motivations are cynical. They are... coming from a bad place right from the start.
So actually, what I think we do to finish this paragraph is compare Gerald's treatment of Eva Smith to Eric's. Because, of course, Eric rapes her. He talks about how he was in a state when a chap easily turns nasty and he threatened to make a row. So he forces himself upon her when they have sex. But actually, what I think structurally we see is this is not that different from Gerald's treatment of Eva.
Yeah.
Whilst he doesn't rape her, while she's willing because of the power imbalance between them, because of how
there's still a power play going on, isn't there?
In both cases, we have an example of a man expressing their power over a woman. And I think that's what this paragraph's all about. Mr. Burling has
this three cases,
power.
Really, yeah. In the Burling case as well, we're seeing that in a different form, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think that's why the last quotation I'd be thinking about this paragraph is the inspector is the one who recognises this. He says to Eric, "You used her for the end of a stupid drunken night, as if she were an animal, a thing, not a person." But actually, we could extend the inspector's comment further and actually say that Mr. Burling and Gerald do the same thing. What they all do
is the key word there, isn't it? It's not the word that first jumps out at you, because obviously you think, okay, an animal, a thing, that's where the deep language analysis is. And I would agree, that is where the deep language analysis is. But actually in that verb used, you can do a huge amount with that, because for all three of the men in the play, she was there to be used in some degree or other. She was there to be used. And of course, the implication with the word use is you only use something for as long as it is useful.
Yeah.
And for all of them, we see, well, perhaps less so with Eric, but for all of them, we see that she ran her use, right? And that once she wasn't useful anymore, they were more than happy to toss her aside.
Yeah. I mean, I think that brings us quite nicely to our next paragraph, which is looking at the parallels then between Sheila and Eva. So, paragraph two. Yeah, Priestley likewise...
We're going to ramp up the pace a bit here, I think, because we're already 18 minutes in, so we're going to fly through these second two paragraphs. So,
Priestley likewise explores how the upper middle class of Sheila's views are marginalised in the Burling household, and how both her father and fiancé appear to ignore or patronise her.
Yes, right, good. So we're now seeing a woman who, because of her social status, doesn't get mistreated in the same way that Eva does, obviously, but there's still evidence of the way the patriarchal society, the society that favours men, treat Sheila in a negative way.
Yeah, I mean, because the easiest one is in Act One, the first thing Burling says as he toasts his daughter's engagement is he says he thinks about a time when Crofts and Burlings are no longer competing but working together. I mean, imagine at your wedding day, Mr. Galley, that I was privileged to attend. Imagine if, you know, your father had stood up and said, "Isn't it great that now I'm going to make more money?"
It would have been odd.
It would have been really
and untrue.
The framing of marriage as an economic transaction, which fails to, again, which objectifies his daughter, sees her, like Eva, as a commodity.
Yeah. So she's just, in a sense, in Burling's eyes, Eva's just a slightly prettier. Pretty is the wrong word. I don't mean that in like, but as Sheila's a slightly nicer object, right? She's still an object. She's still there to be used in such a way as to make his life better. He just cares about her more because
The only difference is that she's an object that isn't interchangeable, whereas Eva is one which is interchangeable. Yeah. That's the only difference. They're both objectified.
That's a very good way of putting it, yeah.
And we see this in Act 1 as well, when he tries to protect her from the inspector, saying he doesn't want her dragged into it. And that verb dragged is repeat twice, which I think, again, is suggesting that he's objectifying her. He's suggesting that she lacks agency. She can't choose to be part of the inspector's discussion. She has to be dragged into it.
It's
quite interesting and very different from the inspector, who says she isn't living on the moon. I think that's a really interesting juxtaposition between the two, that the inspector thinks she's separate to all of this unless she's dragged into it, whereas the inspector recognises
that... Burling thinks that.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Burling thinks she's... whereas the inspector thinks, you know, she's not living on the moon, she's actually present. She's aware of the reality of the world.
Yeah, okay, nice.
And I mean, the other great example that I'd obviously give is when Sheila starts to change. She has her moral and social epiphany. She recognises what's wrong with the world. She starts to give advice. And what does everyone do to her? Mrs. Burling calls her a hysterical child. Gerald patronises her, saying she's had a long and exciting day and that she's obviously had about as much as she can stand. The assumption from all those around her is that she's a hysterical woman.
Yeah. A nice sort of AO3 point is, hysterical is a word that has kind of historically always been used to keep women down, essentially. Well, I didn't phrase that in a very good way, but the idea that a woman showing emotion, even if that's completely justifiable emotion, hysterical is this idea that your emotion is irrational, right? That it's hysteria, that it's almost like an illness.
Well, it was in Victorian society, it was seen as an illness that women suffered from.
And it's the most dismissive thing, isn't it? Oh, she's hysterical, you know, she doesn't know what she's saying. When actually the irony, and our students could go a bit further and look into a little bit of extra research they could do. They could think about the metaphor of the rope and also of the wall being broken down that we talked about in another podcast, which ironically show that Sheila, far from being hysterical, is actually learning quicker and more effectively than anyone in that room.
Yeah, she recognises that they can't build up a kind of wall between us and that girl because the inspector will break it down. She's the only one that recognises the truth. And one last point on hysteria is actually the root of the word, the etymological root. It comes from the words meaning of the womb. So actually the word itself is quite misogynistic in its connotations, that it implies that these emotions come from the hormones produced by the womb itself.
Yeah.
So the last kind of point is just that actually there is a slight counter argument here, that actually Sheila is not the same as Eva Smith, and actually she's not entirely lacking power, she's not entirely lacking agency, because it's of course her puerile, you know, reasons, her childish reasons for getting Eva Smith fired shows that she does actually have some kind of power, and that power comes down not from her gender, from her social class. So I think a slight counter argument is that while she's clearly objectified, while she's clearly part of the patriarchy, she does still, as a from her social class, have some kind of power that Eva Smith lacks.
Got you. Very nice. So we're going to fly into paragraph 3, the last big paragraph, the last section of our argument before our conclusion.
Yeah, let's talk about the inspector. So it is significant, therefore, that the inspector's empathy towards the disenfranchised, that's people who have no power, makes his view of women markedly different from that of Mr. Burling, Gerald, or even the more sympathetic Eric.
Errol.
Because crucially, the inspector brings about a moral and social epiphany in both Eric and Sheila. They change.
Epiphany is a moment when you sort of wake up, right? The inspector changes the young people. They become different.
Yeah. And they seem to recognise not simply the privilege of their social class and wealth, but also the gender inequalities of late Edwardian society. And the inspector, I think let's just look at Act 3, the inspector's final speech. He tells all of them to remember the horrible death she had and that they each helped kill her. His message is about trying to see Eva Smith as an individual initially, so that actually recognising the realities of being a woman in late Edwardian society, what has it done to Eva Smith?
And actually, a good thing to think about there, I always think, is that Priestley didn't need to make her die such a brutal and horrible death. The play could have functioned just as well. The story would have worked in the same way had she stepped in front of a tram or jumped off a bridge or done something that would have killed her instantly. Priestley made her die a horrific, drawn out, painful death. And I think there's a metaphor in there, isn't there, that this was the death that society served her up. The treatment of the Burlings and the treatment of wider society as a whole was horrible, was cruel, and went on for a long time. And her death is symbolic of that. She did not die a quick, clean. I'm sorry if talking about suicide like this upsets any of our listeners or whatever. But the point I'm trying to make is that the horrible death Priestley brings is, I think, symbolic of the way that society had treated her.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of maybe the last point, that actually the inspector clearly functions as a mouthpiece for Priestley. So he represents Priestley's views. And moments before he leaves the stage, there's a wonderful adverb, plangently, that I'd kind of like to introduce, that is kind of like a sound that's loud and resonant, but sad. I think that's the best, a really good way of talking about it. I put it on the sheet, but he plangently says there are millions and millions and millions of Eva Smiths and John Smiths left with us with their lives, their hopes and dreams, fears, their suffering and chance of happiness, all intertwined with our lives. So I think crucially, so plangently, he kind of, this metaphor leaves us with this vision of society, the social classes being intertwined, but also the genders being intertwined. The vision he gives us for change is one which brings about a breakdown of the class inequality, but also a breakdown of the gender inequality. That seems to be the message. And the irony is, of course, it takes fire and blood and anguish for people to recognise this. And the truth is, historically, I mean, for the final point, it took the First World War to bring about suffrage for women. It took the Second World War to bring about because note how first wave feminism comes to its crux after the First World War. Second wave feminism comes out of after the Second World War. The truth is that it takes fire and blood and anguish, as the inspector notes, for people to recognise the inequality and perhaps start to address it.
Perhaps, and this is something, the coronavirus will come. Social positive. Social,
well, that was the one change. Thing maybe to leave, like, I mean, for our conclusion of the essay, of course, we will talk about what's Priestley's message about women. He wants to break down gender inequalities, but actually think about the resonances for us. We're living in a time that's terrifying, isn't it? Quarantine, coronavirus.
Well, yeah.
But the one thing I'd like to leave our listeners with is the sense that actually, if you look at historical precedents, often these times of global catastrophe enable us to step back and think about what is wrong,
what actually matters,
what matters, what was wrong with the world we had before. So hopefully, just like the inspector here, the fire and blood and anguish can bring about some kind of positive change.
Yes, very nice. We should just say quickly, because we've discussed suicide, if that has brought anything up for you, then we'd recommend the Samaritans or Childline as both very good places to go if you are struggling with anything. Or Mind is a fantastic mental health charity, mind.co.uk. So there are lots of places you can go if that brought anything up for you today. And we are sorry if that was the case. Cool. All right. Well, thank you for joining us today. You can, as ever, access all of our material at englishrevisionpod.co.uk, where all of our episodes are. Links to our episodes and the handouts that come with them, or your favorite podcast app. We are on Spotify, we are on Acast, we are on Apple Podcast app, we are in all of those places. You can follow us on Twitter at GRevisionPod, and you can email us, Mr. Forster.
You always put me on the spot. EnglishRevisionPod@gmail.com.
But you always do it so brilliantly well. I like you to end with that real moment of triumph from getting the email address right. Right, guys, thank you for joining us. We sincerely hope that you and all your families are doing okay in this really, really difficult time. And we will see you very, very soon on English Revision Pod.